You're listening to Privacy Files, the podcast that makes privacy approachable for businesses and consumers alike. This episode is brought to you by Anonymy Labs, makers of MySudo, the world's only all-in-one privacy app. At Sudo Platform, the cloud-based platform companies turn to for seamlessly integrating privacy solutions into their software. Welcome to episode number 34 of Privacy Files. I'm Rich.
And I'm Sarah.
In our last episode, we recorded the show from the Utah Bridal and Wedding Expo in downtown Salt Lake City, where I interviewed several people to get a female perspective on privacy and safety. Today, we're exploring collegiate life. No, not tailgating, although that would be a fun topic. We're taking a hard look at student privacy. In 2023, how do you maintain privacy while going to college? Is it even achievable? And to help us with this discussion, we have Connor with us here in studio. Connor is a senior at the University of Utah, located right here in Salt Lake City. Connor, welcome to Privacy Files.
Thank you, Rich. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you. I can't wait to hear kind of what's going on these days on the college campus regarding privacy. Being someone in your age cohort, you're the Gen Z group, as they affectionately call them, the Zoomers, as I just learned recently, which I think is so funny. Zoom, zoom, zoom.
And they're the pandemic students, so I'm excited to hear about this.
Yeah, but you've really never known a life of true privacy, and you've grown up pretty much without knowing anything other than the internet.
Very true. For people my age, I kind of see it as it's unconscious to us that how much information is out there on us. And through so much of my life has everything been online through socials, and even college now, it's like all online. All of your assignments, all your tests, it's all online. And so I was probably 20 in my junior year when I first started to think about my personal information and privacy online. So yeah, and when you have that kind of realization, it's a little scary, it's a little overwhelming.
And it's been a while for me since I've been on a college campus. And Sarah, I'm sure it's been a little while for you.
But it has. It's been 13 years now. It doesn't feel like that long, but yeah, just to hear how much is online, it's like I sort of had some study, not even exams were online when I was there. They had, I don't even know how they prevent cheating. I don't know if it's like a big problem they've got now. And we've talked about ChatGPT being involved with writing papers, but everything I did was, you know, filling out bubbles or writing, you know, all my tests were handwritten. So,
well, speaking of the cheating stuff, we're going to get into a story very, very similar to that. And as we've said many times in past episodes there, everything starts with our good old friend, March 2020.
Always.
So there's an article, and we talked a little bit, I think, a few days ago, Connor, when we were talking about ideas for this episode, this concept of remote proctoring.
Yeah, definitely had an experience with that during my, it was my sophomore year is when they started. It was a company by the name of ProctorU. And what it was is to take a test in class, because at this point it was all online. It was all Zoom classes. And you would have to add this browser extension called ProctorU. And within the extension, it recorded your screen and you had to give it access to your computer. And then you would have to turn, your camera would be on, obviously, and you would have to scan your room that you were taking the test in to ensure that no one was in there. You didn't have any notes out. This wasn't something that was live monitored. It wasn't like someone was watching you, you know, and to see if there was stuff you would cheat. This is videos that they would save and then later come back to.
Sarah's over there.
Feels so invasive already, and we've just started.
And just all your not even the stuff. Privacy angle, but think about being a student and all those eyes on you. I mean, everyone would rather be in a big, you know, in a big auditorium taking
hidden
a test.
When you're one of 100. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
So it definitely, in my experience, felt like a violation of privacy, of course. And, you know, not only to show your room, but to have to give access to your personal computer to a third party company, by the way. This is not something that the university came up with. This wasn't, you know, some vertical integration by the university. This is something that they, you know, combined with.
They implemented it.
So in terms of all of that data, who knows where that is? You know, someone probably has a nice video of my dorm room with all my dirty clothes laying around and, you know.
Yeah, I didn't know that's what was involved, having to give not only access to your computer, it's got a camera on you and you have to scan your room to prove. That's just a lot. I guess I would just go find a blank white room to just be like, this is all you get.
And it almost seems like, too, that, you know, that age cohort, I mean, how many people are really going to speak up? You're just trying to get through it. You don't, you know, it's you kind of take advantage of that, a younger audience like that. Yeah, they don't know.
They're stressed over exams anyways. They'll just do what they need to pass.
So that will lead us into this topic. This came from Cal Matters on February 27th of 2023. It says California College is still using remote proctoring despite court decision. So like many college students, Aaron Ogletree found himself attending classes from home in spring 2021. And the Cleveland State sophomore took exams. This was in Ohio, from his bedroom, the only place to find quiet and privacy in a home he shared with his mother and two siblings. Less than 2 hours before he was scheduled to take one remote chemistry exam, according to court documents, Ogletree was shocked to receive an email informing him that he would be required to have his room remotely scanned by an online proctoring service. Remote proctoring software gained popularity, of course, during the COVID period as a way for universities to ensure that students sitting for exams miles from campus weren't cheating. But Ogletree, who said he had confidential tax documents littered across his desk, viewed the room scan as an invasion of his privacy. Now, Connor, when you had your room scanned, were you kind of mindful of what was available and as easily viewable?
If I remember correctly, I cleared about everything off of my desk just in fear that something might get flagged, because that was the main thing. They were looking for papers, something with writing on it, as if you were, you know, cheating. So out of fear of getting tagged and then your test just automatically failed because they saw something that was cheating, you know, everything was cleared.
I can't imagine what that process would be like if you got failed for it and then like trying to prove that what was sitting on your desk wasn't cheating. Like, I can't imagine trying to argue that with my professor or something.
I would just be worried that there'd be something embarrassing just sitting around or just something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, you know, how do you trust those people? Like, it goes back to the, I don't know what you call them. I always call them the naked body scanners at the airport that they make you go through with TSA. But there's been stories of TSA agents saving those scans when people pass through and they're supposed to delete them immediately. And you'd wonder, like, who's really monitoring that?
Yeah,
it's something I try not to think about.
Just close your eyes and keep walking. Yeah. That's interesting. It seems like it'd be sort of hard for all of these students to stress over that every time they've got to take an exam or something, to make sure your living conditions were just right so that you weren't worried that some technicality would cause you to fail something you just studied so hard for.
I just remembered an additional thing with the proctored exams. So not only, you know, it would be recording, but it would track your eye movements. And if your eyes pointed away from your screen, there was like a percentage. It was like a score. If you got below, like, let's say 85%, you would fail for cheating. Gosh.
You know what? I remember my husband taking some sort of assessment online. This was not even during school. So some company is using this for their own. And he was like, I can't look up at you. I can't look up at you. Because like, I would walk in the door, just be like, hey, are you still like taking your test or something? And they knew it is such an invasion. You just think about it. It's not even maybe just college campuses that this software is being used for. But if your company or whoever you're trying to get hired for is requiring an assessment, you never know if they're, you know, you've got to be aware of what type of programs they're using during your assessment.
Especially if you're trying to minimize eye fatigue. For me, sometimes I have to look away.
Yeah. When you're thinking, you sort of naturally like will look up in a corner or something, but don't do that. Just stare at your computer.
Yeah.
Cry while you look at your computer. Don't look away.
So continue on with the article. So Ogletree complied, but later filed suit against Cleveland State, alleging the university violated his Fourth Amendment right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. In the first major legal test to the use of remote proctoring services in higher education, U.S. District Court Judge J. Philip Calabrese agreed in August that the room scanning was unconstitutional, stating that, quote, Mr. Ogletree's privacy interest in his home outweighs Cleveland State's interests in scanning his room. Yet, months later, as Cleveland State appeals the decision, some California schools, they say, are still using e-proctoring software that includes room scans. Now, what about what's going on at the University of Utah? Are they still using this technique?
So I believe that lawsuit actually made them stop using the system, because I'm trying to line up the dates. I believe that would have been the spring of 21 when I had to take that proctored exam and scan my room. after that semester, I never saw a proctored exam again. And I have had online classes since the spring of 21.
What are they doing is a means to kind of vet you out and ensure things are at least on the up and up when you're taking the test. Is there anything that they're doing?
So to respond to not having the proctored program enabled, they have all the students, in my experience, we sit in a Zoom call and the proctor is kind of the professor browsing from screen to screen, I guess, trying to see if, you know, we're cheating based on our body language. And I mean, I don't think anything is really stopping anyone now, but as a student, it feels a lot more comfortable when you're taking a test. The proctored program just made it so hard to focus because you felt the eyes on you, where it's, I mean, technically still in the case of what they're currently doing, but you know, at least you know your professor and the Zoom call isn't being recorded. So there's that.
And you also had to take pictures of your screen as well.
Yeah. So it was like a screen share. You had to upload your screen to their service and they would be recording it and monitoring it. Yeah, they would make sure there was no other documents opened, nothing.
What if you're putting sticky notes on your screen?
I guess that would have been the one way around it. I plead the fifth on that action.
You always wonder though, because sometimes screen sharing can give access to the other person to kind of control your screen. So you wonder if this program has the ability to get in there and do that. You just don't, I guess, unless you're reading privacy policies, you just really don't know. And most college students aren't doing that. So
it's like, I got to get the test.
Yeah, they're like, I'm just stressed. I need to take this test. Just tell me what I need to do.
So it's students taking an exam, they're explaining what they had to go through here in this article. And a lot of it mirrors what you were saying earlier, Connor. Is when they take the exam with remote proctoring, it typically begins by showing an identification card, which the system uses to verify the student's identity. And then they do a webcam check. Certain e-proctoring services require students to show their room's surroundings. They also often have to take a picture of the computer itself. You know, that might uncover anybody putting sticky notes on their screen.
That was probably post my experience. they probably heard through the grapevine that there was some sticky note action.
During live proctoring, the instructor or a proctor can view the student while they take the exam via a video conference. At the same time, a lockdown browser monitors potential cheating on the computer itself. So I'm not familiar. What is a lockdown browser?
So that's kind of like what the screen sharing would do.
Okay.
So it would like ping if you opened up another tab.
So
all of college assignments, essentially, I mean, most of them for assignments are uploading files to a program called Canvas, but the tests and quizzes are just on Canvas. So it's not something you upload, you take it in the program. So the lock browser would make sure you stay in that browser. And if I remember correctly, I don't know if it would prevent you from leaving, but I think you would get pinged if you did leave or open another.
That's intense.
Sarah, this sounds worse than an in-person test.
It really kind of does. I think I'd have more anxiety worrying about clicking the wrong thing for a technicality, like I mentioned. You're just like, you don't know how to defend yourself.
So they're also talking about other ways to verify and go through all these processes to make sure you're the person you say you are. Some tools then ensure that the same individual is solving the exam throughout the time with the help of several methods, such as challenge questions, signature biometrics, keystroke biometrics, knuckle biometrics, and facial recognition. I've never heard of knuckle biometrics.
News to me.
Are your knuckles unique?
I guess the way they're curved, who knows? That's a lot of biometrics. And you're like, where is that being stored? And how are you validating? You know, it's like, what data do you have that you're validating that my biometrics are scanning and they're approved?
Yikes.
This is a deeper hole than I expected coming into today.
And some systems, including Respondus, which is one of the proctoring companies cited in the Cleveland State case, also offer a fully automated proctoring option, which allows students to record themselves taking the exam through their webcam. The instructor or a professional proctor is then able to view the recording afterwards, and the system flags any potential violations. The nonprofit digital rights advocacy organization Fight for the Future, which has led campaigns to ban e-proctoring, refers to the technology as glorified spyware and argues that it's dangerous to give companies access to students' personal information and biometric data such as face, voice, and fingerprints. Yeah, I think I'd have to agree. These companies, who were already kind of taking hold before the pandemic, really sunk their teeth in by convincing colleges and universities that your students are taking tests at home, so you have to subject them to invasive surveillance in order to maintain the academic integrity, said Fight for the Future's director, Evan Greer. He continues by saying, we're normalizing the practice of handing over our sensitive biometric information to our schools, and most people just do not truly understand the potential risks associated with that. Meaningful consent means you have to really understand what you're consenting to, and since most people don't have an understanding of what it means to hand their biometric information over to a company, I don't think that's really meaningful consent, as Greer continues.
I always wonder how I would have been if I would have gone through this time. Like, hindsight's always easy because now I'm a different person. I see things differently than I did when I was in college. So I always wonder if I'd be like, oh, this is so cool. I get to, you know, I don't know if I would have thought everything was like just cool and high tech, or if I would have been pushing back, because I have a tendency to push back nowadays. But I just feel like, and if I had that tendency to push back, if you are somebody that's like, hey, like, I'm not okay with this, then it's like, well, do you want to take this and pass the class, or do you want to, you know, put your foot down and throw a hissy fit about it, you know? So you're kind of like, these poor kids are just like, I don't know if they even had a choice at the time if you wanted to pass your class.
Let's take a quick break for this message from our sponsor.
Are you tired of big tech spying on you? MySudo is the world's only all-in-one app that gives you back control of your privacy. By creating digital profiles or sudos, you can compartmentalize your online activities by setting up a unique phone number, email address, and handle for things like shopping, accessing free content, and using dating apps. This breaks the data trail linking back to your personal info, thus reducing your digital exhaust. Each sudo also includes a private web browser with add-in tracker blocker. Want to stop companies from sharing data related to your transactions and spending habits? Set up a MySudo virtual card and bring peace of mind that your transactions are secure and private. To learn more, visit MySudo.com. That's MySudo.com. Stay private.
Connor, when they were doing this, did they ever tell you what the procedures or protocols were for on the university side, let's say? Like, who had access to this information? Were they storing it? Did anybody tell you, or was it just, hey, go read the fine print?
They never really gave us easy accessibility to go read the fine print. Even if we went off on our own, we probably could find it, but I never took the effort. I mean, college students are just so vulnerable during this time, and especially during the pandemic, there's just so much frustration as a college student. And so the most we were told is that, depending on the test, there was different versions of proctored, like proctored exams, as you read. So I took a couple. Some of them were just the like screen recordings or screen lockings. And then I had one that was really bad where I had to scan my whole room. But the only thing I really heard was like, it will be recorded and then watched by a proctored, you know, someone who works for the company to make sure that nothing was flagged. But yeah, just during this time, there was just like, college students were so vulnerable. We were so frustrated. You know, we just wanted to get through it. And like Sarah said, you know, do you stomp your foot or do you just follow along? But, you know, during that time, it was just pass the class, get it over with. You know, we lived in such a world of unknown at the time, you know, being told, oh, the pandemic will last till Easter. But, you know, we all saw how that went. So, I mean, I didn't even expect for school to be online for more than 3 months. And it lasted for me for almost 2 years. So you kind of just got to a point where you didn't care, you know? And that's a problem, but you got to that point where you didn't care. You know, you just wanted to get through it.
I bet you some of that is stored on someone's laptop still somewhere.
Just checking y'all out when they're bored.
Yeah. Hey, look at Connor's dirty closet. So Cleveland State is currently appealing the federal court's decision, last I could tell, which focused specifically on room scanning and did not address whether e-proctoring as a whole is permissible. So the scanning, you know, pretty questionable, I guess, which I would say it is. But the e-proctoring thing looks like it's not only still alive, but it's growing. And Sarah's got a little bit of data to talk about that supports that.
Yeah. So there's an article by Globe Newswire. It actually just came out a couple days ago, May 22nd. It's the compound annual growth rate, it says, of online exam proctoring market is to gain $3.8 million by 2032. So according to this market.us, study they did, the online exam proctoring market size is projected to surpass $3.9 billion by 2032 from $742 million in 2022, and it is poised to reach a compound annual growth rate of 18.5% from 2023 to 2032. So the live online proctoring segment has generated a revenue share of 75% in 2022, and the school and university segment has dominated the market and is growing at the highest compound annual growth rate over the forecast period of 2023 to 2032.
You made that $4 billion market just from remote proctoring.
Yeah. And anytime I'm sort of like, they said it's like spyware, and you're just like, they are making so much money. And we always say like your data and your information is what people are making money on. So I'm really curious as to how I guess everybody's just implementing it more, and that's where things are coming from, but also selling that data and selling that information is also very lucrative. So
it's just unfortunate that the people who are making these decisions and doing this thing are never going to experience it.
Right.
You know, they're already done with their college experience, so they don't know what it's like taking the test during it. And I almost guarantee you that any student you asked who took a proctored exam feels like they would have scored higher if they were in a regular setting.
I wonder how the schools get sold on this too. You know, somebody shows up with some slick suit and tie and has got his little briefcase, or just, I don't know who they talk to.
Well, it's funny because they're probably selling on ethics, but what's ethical about scanning a student's room?
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, no cheating. But you would think also it's just like the lack of faith in students at that point too. And it's, you know.
Yeah, you're just assuming everybody is there to cheat.
Yeah.
And it's like in 2020, 2021, I'm sure they were sold on this idea like, well, you got to keep everybody safe. Don't let them in classrooms. And this is how you're going to do it. And we have the technology to make sure they're not cheating, because I'm sure that's what you guys are worried about. It's sort of a lack of faith in your students to just be assuming everybody is cheating. And so you have to take these drastic measures.
Okay, Connor, so you kind of talked about a little bit here in the beginning when you started thinking about privacy. Could you give us a little bit more context of what that moment was like? When did you really start thinking about it? What spurred that whole mindset?
Yeah, of course. So junior year, I believe spring semester, I want to say, I took a class. It was called Advertising Creative. And the whole class was based around, the professor had been a longtime creative director, had worked on ads for Super Bowls and stuff. And he really did not like the current status of advertising. He felt like, you know, the whole data banks and stuff, it didn't make for good creative advertising. So he suggested to us like, hey, turn off your cookies on everything you do. Yeah, like everywhere, because you're going to get these targeted ads. You'll never see what general advertising is right now, and you'll never see how bad it is, like the current state of it. So that got me thinking. I was like, oh my goodness, my cookie trail has got all these targeted ads. So that was really when I started to think about it. It was like, seriously, at least. And even though the professor was more looking at the angle of like becoming more creative with your advertising, the outcome for me was realizing how much data like Google has on me. And just that revelation was insane.
How much has been compiled on you, yeah, and just tailored, and they've built this profile of you.
And so I guess you didn't have the most traditional collegiate experience, yeah, but do you have a sense for how students are viewing privacy and just their own kind of personal data and managing that?
I definitely think there's either a knowledge gap or it's just unconscious. You know, college students have so much going on that they just don't think about it. And even though it's really important, it's just like in the back of our minds. And I can say that personally, I probably still wouldn't have had the understanding of how my data is being tracked if I didn't have that class, or at least cared to learn about it. And so I think that's the problem, is we don't realize, or, you know, we're so caught up in our own lives currently, we don't realize what the backlash is going to be.
Yeah.
I feel like college students in a sense as well are sort of like, they feel sheltered still. You know, you feel like you're sort of in the big scary world, but not quite yet. And so there are some things that you're like, oh, that doesn't really apply to me. It's just like, you've got other things to worry about, just like he was saying. And so it's like, I don't think you realize data collection starts. I mean, we've talked about this. It can start from the day you're born with what they're collecting on you. But it's like, especially this generation growing up on social media, and they're just on the internet all the time, that data like has just been compiled and compiled as soon as you're on social media. And it's like you're hitting college campus now where a lot of your personal information is now you're 18, you're an adult. It's time for you to start providing this information, start memorizing that social security number so you can provide it when it's needed. And it's just now it's all being collected on such a mass scale. And I know there's times where even me and my husband will still get things from our college, like in the mail. Like, first of all, they're always asking for money. I'm like, you already took enough of my money. You don't need more of that. But things just continue to follow you years and decades after you've left college. And it's just, there's just been so much data collected. But like you said, it's just, it's not on the forefront of your mind when you're young and you're 18, 19, maybe 20. You've got other things to worry about, but not thinking about how this is going to affect you after graduation.
What about you, Sarah? What were you like in college? Were you mindful of this or?
Absolutely not. I'm very different than I was back then. I mean, there's aspects, but I just sort of lived in this happy little bubble. But at the same time, I've talked about how Instagram didn't come out until 2010, and that's when I graduated. So we really just had Facebook, which obviously they're collecting their own information, but our photo uploads were from a camera that we connected to the laptop and said, this is what we did this weekend, you know? So I think we had less information out there. And anytime I was signing up for something, it was like on paper. I don't know if it even got entered into a database. I'm not sure. But it's just crazy to see how 10, 12, 13 years later, it is so different than when I was in college. I was like, if I ever had to go back, I feel like I would just be lost. It was just, it seems so different.
So Connor, at any point, let's say during orientation or at any point during your tenure as a student at the University of Utah, did the school in an official capacity talk to you about privacy?
No, I don't believe not in this matter. No, I don't think so. I mean, they have their kind of lessons on alcohol and sexual assault.
Safety,
but,
personal
yeah,
safety.
Yeah, safety, yeah. Which is good, but they don't really talk about the digital side. And, you know, it makes you think, is it on purpose? Are they collecting my information? Or yeah.
You know? You do wonder, because it's like you are a part of their establishment. You are going to their school. And so they're probably sort of like, well, we want to keep tabs on our students, you know? Yeah. So if you know how to get around things and bypass things, they can't probably keep tabs on you as well. But you would hope all they care about is that you're going to class and that you're paying your dues and you graduate. But they could be collecting the data to sell it just like any other business.
And let me tell you, going to college, you realize they'll do anything for a little extra cash, $400 for a parking permit.
Oh my goodness. It adds up so fast.
I know.
When I was an undergrad, it was selling your blood plasma. I did that
a couple years ago. Oh, I get it.
You did? Yeah, yeah.
I get it. Yes.
And they're like, and they advertise like, yeah. Oh, just sit there in the comfortable seat,
yeah,
and you can study for your test while we're just taking your plasma.
Those poor students. They're just, they need it. Selling their bikes, they're just selling anything to make payments for textbooks.
Yep.
So Connor, let's start with the oh so fun topic of group projects.
Ooh,
okay. I'm
curious how this happened. While you were in school.
Yeah, we all love those.
So a lot of the communication is a lot more virtual than I'm sure either of you ever experienced. In terms of communication, generally speaking, in my experience, they would all just be group chats over like text messages, like iMessage generally. Most students have an iPhone, I would wager 75%.
Yeah, you know, there's not a lot of Androids on campus.
Not that I've seen. Usually like an iMessage group chat. I have had groups where we've tried to do things like Discord and GroupMe, but they just kind of never fall through. The iMessage usually seems to be the simplest method. And then for meetings, I'm sure you guys would have to, you know, go find a place, a coffee shop or something.
We're always at the library meeting in groups.
So, I mean, this was, I guess, one benefit from the pandemic. And I don't know about this data, but Zoom was a great tool that it was able, so we could just meet wherever and worked with people's schedules, especially those who worked as well as went to school. But yeah, so mainly for group projects, it was through just text message chats. That being said, now I have I don't even know how many people have my personal phone number that I do not care to have. Myself as well. I need to clean that out. I got some names in there that
you're like, I don't even remember
on the
who
naughty
this was.
List.
Yeah,
know?
So I guess projects are more, I mean, you think of projects and it's not like you're building arts and crafts together. It is really just collaboration and pretty much like, okay, you take this part of the project, I'll do this part. So I guess Zoom would suffice in a sense.
Yeah.
And, but you're forced to be with people that maybe you wouldn't necessarily hang out with. And so,
right.
But you've got to communicate. There's no way around that. So are students LinkedIn active?
I would say, yeah. Yeah. I personally wasn't the most LinkedIn active. I would have my LinkedIn profile, I guess, up to date with my current like job experience. I wasn't much of one who would network on it quite as much as I am now, but I've definitely met students, especially those who are really into the college life or getting into the clubs and stuff. But I would reckon that those are people who are spend most of their lives during this period on campus doing stuff. I chose to get a job and work part-time. So,
but students were not really communicating through the LinkedIn platform.
I wouldn't say so. Unless you're kind of, I mean,
maybe if you're starting a job hunt a little bit.
I've sent messages on there in endeavors of like my entrepreneurial side of things where I've reached out to people about certain skill sets that I would wish to develop and ask for their help.
You mentioned a couple of days ago as we were preparing for this episode, you mentioned an app. I think it was called Be Real. You said something like that. That was kind of taking the campus by storm.
Yeah, I would say that's the newest one. About almost everyone I know uses it. I don't use it personally.
How does it work?
So it's the whole idea behind it, I guess, is be more authentic on social media, which to me is funny. It's still social media.
It's an oxymoron. Yeah.
But they just send you a message, like a notification. You have, I think, 2 minutes to take a picture and post. And I've since learned that you can turn it off, but it's not like a right away, like they ask you, but they have geolocation on it. So, you know, you take your picture, it knows exactly where you are. And then it starts like mapping out where you spend your days.
It reminds me of the Pokemon Go where it's like mapping out to send you advertisements for where you are.
So that's one of the reasons I don't care for it. I don't care to get it.
What's the revenue model? I mean, were there advertisements in the app?
I'm not sure. I've never personally used it. I just have friends and my girlfriend's always posting on it. And so, you know, they probably see her. It's like, all right, work and then your apartment. That's
right. For the average person, it's going to be pretty much the same thing every day. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So,
all right, let me cover a little bit about the FERPA, I guess, which is the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. I think, you know, you can chime in whenever you want on this, Connor, but this really just covers more of your educational records. So it's a federal law that protects the privacy of student education records. It applies to all schools that receive funds under an applicable program of the U.S. Department of Education. FERPA gives parents certain rights with respect to their children's education records. These rights transfer to the student when he or she reaches the age of 18 or attends a school beyond the high school level. Students to whom the rights have transferred are eligible students. So it gets into a lot of this, these details. Did they talk about this at all to you during orientation or at any point in your student
tenure? I can't remember. I can't pinpoint the moment exactly, but I do remember setting up my own. Once I had entered college, I set up like my own personal one because the records were now mine instead of, you know, under my parents. So set up my own. They have a thing called the FERPA PIN, and you have to give that out before anyone can look at your records other than yourself. So anytime I meet with a college advisor or career services at the university, they always have to ask for my FERPA PIN before they can access any of my academic records.
Because when I was an undergrad, whenever you wanted to have transcripts sent to, like, say, a graduate school, if you were applying, you literally have to request them. And they were really in like writing. They were printed out. They were put in an envelope. They were sealed with maybe some tape, and then there was just like a stamp that went on the outside of them. And it had your social security information in there, all your personal identifiable information along with your transcripts, and anybody could open it. I mean, it's pretty obvious that it was an official transcript from a college or a university. And, you know, there was part of me that thought, ooh, you know, it was even worse than having a new credit card sent to you, I thought, because that's information was already there. At least with the new credit card, you got to go through the process of activating and everything. So that, I'm sure that's changed a lot. I don't know if you've considered grad school at any point, but are you aware of what the process is today if you want to request your official transcript from the University of Utah to have it sent somewhere else? Is it all electronic now?
I'm not sure if the outcome is like through an electronic, like if it's through like an encrypted or secure email, or if it is still physical. I know that the process is all on, like for me requesting it is online, but I'm unsure. I haven't had to request an official transcript yet, so I'm unsure. Okay. I've seen like the unofficial transcripts, like we can do that where it doesn't contain like the key personal information, like your social, like you said. And you can just get a PDF of that pretty quickly. It takes a couple minutes for them to just like upload to you. It's in like a private University of Utah browser. Okay.
So it's gotten a little better.
Yeah. When you were speaking about social security numbers, I was talking to my dad and he went to the University of Utah. I'd have to track back the days when he graduated. It was probably sometime in the 80s. But he told me that when he was going, when they would get their test scores, I mean, there was no real, like, you know, for now it's like I check my Canvas to see what I got in the test. But they would post on a wall in like a big bulletin board, and their IDs were their social security numbers.
I remember hearing about this. It's just printed on a paper.
Yeah. On the wall.
Identified yourself.
And so I don't know if that came with their name along with it, but
good times.
I know.
I may quickly go through just the rest of the FERPA stuff, and then Sarah's going to get us into the interesting topic of sororities and fraternities. Ooh, that sounds exciting. So parents or eligible students have the right to inspect and review the student's education records maintained by the school. Schools are not required to provide copies of record unless for reasons such as grade distance. It is impossible for parents or eligible students to review the records, and then schools may charge a fee for copies. So parents or eligible students have the right to request that a school correct records which they believe to be inaccurate or misleading. If the school decides not to amend the record, the parent or eligible student then has the right to a formal hearing. That would be interesting. After the hearing, if the school still decides not to amend the record, the parent or eligible student has the right to place a statement with the record setting forth his or her view about the contested information. Yeah, well, I'd love to see that. I really would love to see how that process goes. Generally, schools must have written permission from the parent or eligible student in order to release any information from a student's education record. However, FERPA allows schools to disclose those records without consent to the following parties or under the following conditions: school officials with legitimate educational interest, other schools to which a student is transferring, specified officials for audit or evaluation purposes, appropriate parties in connection with financial aid to a student, organizations conducting certain studies for or on behalf of the school, accrediting organizations to comply with a judicial order or lawfully issued subpoena, appropriate officials in cases of health and safety emergencies, that's always an emergency, and state and local authorities within the juvenile justice system pursuant to specific state law. So students may disclose without consent directory information such as a student's name, address, telephone number, date, and place of birth, honors and awards, and dates of attendance. However, schools must tell parents and eligible students about directory information and allow parents and eligible students a reasonable amount of time to request that the school not disclose directory information about them. Schools must notify parents and eligible students annually of their rights under FERPA. The actual means of notification, special letter, inclusion in a PTA bulletin, student handbook, or newspaper article, is left to the discretion of each school. Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah. You need an attorney.
Yep.
All right, Sarah, let's go into the life of sororities and fraternities.
Yeah. So as far as campus activities go, this honestly could probably apply to any club nowadays. I'm sure things are so streamlined, and I was involved in a sorority as well as it's still there. They call it the MUS, the Mighty Utah Student Section. They attend all the sporting events. They get great tickets to things and stuff like that. So this that I'm going to talk about could apply to any club. This is just things I know about. So when you want to go through the Greek life on campus with a fraternity or sorority, there's even 400 campuses across the country that are actually getting more streamlined with their recruitment process. So this recruitment period actually begins before even school starts, and it even before, has it ended yet? Has school ended yet? Are you guys in testing period?
No, it's been over for
a couple weeks.
For me, it's been almost a month. Finished the 28th of April, but okay. I know that others finished like May 5th.
Got it. So I just saw where recruitment has already opened May 1st. So they're starting to just gather people that are interested in joining for the fall semester. So when school starts and campuses have tables and tables of activities for students to get involved in, that's really like when recruitment starts. And this could be for any club. And there's sort of, for the Greeks, this whole designated condensed week when school starts, where potential new members, they're called PNMs, if you ever see that around, but they'll get to visit every house on campus to get a feel for where they want to end up. And it's always been sort of this bracket system on paper where when you start by visiting them all the first day, then you sort of narrow it down, and the next day you visit fewer, and the next day is fewer, until the last day you're matched with the house that you want to be in. And this process really goes two ways. The potential new members are selecting their top houses and then narrowing it down each night, and the existing house members are making their votes and narrowing down their wanted new members as well. So the University of Utah has 11 fraternities and 9 sororities, and with at least 100 students, if not more, going through this process every fall, and they even have a spring recruitment as well. You can just imagine how long this process can take when you've got to make nightly selections. And I know we would be up until all hours of the night in the morning just discussing new members. And back, this was 2007, 2010, everything was done on paper ballots. And then we would sort of tally those up and email it back to, they call them Panhellenic. They're the ones who are over these new members. And so there's just all this communication, but we were writing ballots down, we were emailing things in. So these potential new members are also submitting their top picks, and we're doing our top picks. And so what this, like I said, it's all on paper. Nowadays, I knew I had heard of this a couple years ago, and especially starting 2020, 2021, there are apps now for this where, it's so much more quick and it's more efficient. It's really become huge around this time. So potential new members, they actually have an app that they can download, and I'm sure other registration processes can be the same. So they'll download this app, and this allows them to get messages during recruitment. They can see a weekly schedule of events, even on campus, and they can enter their selections for each round of recruitment. And then on the other side, there's a sister app that existing members use to place their votes, and everything is tallied and everything is just really taken care of in a couple minutes. So I was reading through, I went through online and was just like, pretending I'm going to register to be in the Greek. And immediately you're sort of filling out this form, and it's asking, there's like a lot of information that's being asked. And so I was like, let me click on the privacy policy and see what's going on here, which, you know, a normal college student wouldn't, but I just wanted to see what they're doing. But so for registering for one of these, it's a bit unsettling with regards to what data they have and what they can do with it. And I get that it's become very streamlined, but like we always say, you need to at least be aware of what's happening with your personal information, and then you can better navigate those websites and apps you're about to use. So from what I gather, there's this company called Campus Director. One word, they really run the registration process for, I'm sure it's for the Greeks, anything the U is running, it's Campus Director. And they connect with these apps across the country. And the app company that really sort of holds this market is called Technify, with a PHI. And they've got these sub apps for the different needs of the recruitment process. So here's some of the policies noted in this privacy policy when you register to join Greek Life. So it says the collection of information. Technify collects information from you in two ways, directly from your input and collects information from third parties and from other users. So if we're all connecting through a single campus or a single Greek house, we're all linked and that's being shared. And it says, unless otherwise provided or granted by Technify, you will neither own nor be given access to any of this information collected from such third parties. Then it says the types of information they collect directly from you. It's your contact information, such as your name, your email address, telephone number, and those of your members within that house, employees and affiliates, your usernames, your passwords, payment information, educational and employment background, comments and feedback, interests and communication preferences, and information about you and your organization's members, employees, and affiliates. And it says Technify automatically collects certain information, such as your IP address, your computer device and connection information, and other technical identifiers, as well as the URL clickstream data, sort of the date and time that you've been clicking on things. So it does say in there that Technify agrees not to share your personal information with other users, groups, and third parties without your permission to do so. But then, like in their next line, They state, nonetheless, Technify has the right to use your personal information collected through the service to complete various actions, which is to provide and improve service and support. We hear that a lot. We're using your data to improve your experience, you know, things like that. And it also says they use it for data analysis, audits, developing new products, and to report industry trends to the public. So to me, it's like these young adults are entering into the big world for the first time and they just want to join clubs and they just want to get involved. And that's a lot of personal information being collected and used indefinitely. So if you want to get involved on campus, whether it's you listening to this podcast or you have a kid about to go through college, it's really tough to avoid giving out your personal information, but you can also try to stay ahead of it with something, you know, like MySudo, where you can use a pseudo email address, a pseudo phone number, and provide them with that when you're registering for any of these clubs, and just begin compartmentalizing things and separating yourself a bit from the data collection minefield. So not only is this information collected up front from day one when you're in a club, so like a sorority or a fraternity, your records actually stay with you with them for life unless you take the steps as an alumni to request it to be permanently removed. Because for us, once you have a member ID, you've gone through initiation and you're in their headquarters system for your specific house, like Delta Gamma or Alpha Chi Omega, you even have access to do membership searches across the country on their website. And you can look at any member in any chapter of your house's name across the country. It's pretty openly visible once you're officially a member. So yeah, I'd say once you're in a sorority or any campus club, there's just, you know, then there's also the social apps. They're all on TikTok or Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube for recruitment videos. I've seen those everywhere. So there's just, and then even the communications, I just try to think of all the ways now that they're utilizing technology in whether it's Greek life or any of these activities. So I just think it's really important if they can take these steps, you know, create a separate email and a contact info for all of that, so you're not muddying the waters with your personal email address or even your assigned school email address. You're just compartmentalizing all that.
I had no idea Greek life was this complicated.
That's just the first week is getting recruitment through. It's
That's
intense.
Nuts.
But it sounds like it's been so streamlined. We used to stay up until all hours having to go through every single person. And now it's just like tap some buttons and, you know, it's like their pictures on there, their information's on there. So you can sort of get their background without having to sit there and discuss it for hours.
So it's a full application
process.
It's
an app. Yeah. Yep. I think it's called Fired Up. I was looking for it with a PHI, but
I'm just kind of curious. So depending on the club, mm-hmm. I'm sure they've got different criteria for who gets picked and, right. but what's involved? I mean, are you sitting down and being interviewed? Are you providing all of your, high school activities?
I mean, these apps and the registration, I was looking even at the registration form and it does ask, what are your hobbies? What are you into? And so that's sort of just like the registration process. But when students are visiting each house, it is such a process that we as existing members, you are talking to as many girls or, you know, the guys are talking to guys. You're talking to as many as you can in like 30 minutes because they're about to move on to the next house and go talk to people. So we are rotating ourselves to talk to each person as much as we can. And then we sort of collaborate in between shifts and say, okay, she said she did this. She does this. She's got these grades, you know, blah, blah, blah. Cause there's minimums you have to make. There's like, oh, you have to have a 3.0 or, you know, you have to make sure they could financially support being in a house or, you know, there's just certain things you're looking for, but you are face to face with them during recruitment week and taking notes and voting on people.
So you're giving them access to some kind of financial data.
I'm not sure if these apps are asking for that. It seems like it could be something that's like, oh, do you pay for school or do your parents pay for it? You know, I'm not sure what they're asking for. I didn't download the app, but I know when we're talking to them, there are ways that you can sort of ask like, oh, are you working? You know, there's ways to ask people if they seem like they financially could handle being in a sorority or fraternity because dues do come with it. It's not super cheap all the time, but yeah. And so now that they've got these apps where you can just input all your data that you want to share with these houses, it's all in there. And you're sort of like, and this privacy policy is telling you they're going to do whatever they want with it and you don't own it. So you just have to be super careful about what you're putting in there.
What about you, Connor? It sounds like you might've avoided Greek life.
Yeah. So I definitely have a unique experience. My first year of college, I lived at home still and It was about 30 minutes directly to campus without any traffic. Some days it would take as much as an hour to get there if it was like morning traffic or afternoon traffic back home. So there was that. I didn't really want to get too involved just because I didn't want to be my entire social life downtown when I lived, you know, 30 minutes to an hour away. So I didn't get involved my first year. I thought about, you know, getting more involved in the campus life, but then the pandemic happened quickly after that. So,
yeah. And I even think about like dorms and stuff. When you have to register for dorms, they've got to make sure, you know, they're doing background checks on your finances and making sure you can pay for it and checking meal plans if you need to be on a special meal plan and things like that.
On the apps that you were talking about, I do have some experience with that. Not personally, but my freshman year before the pandemic, I had a friend who, she was in a sorority. And part of the, I don't know if it was because she was, I think she was already in it. So I think it was just something that anyone in the sorority had to do. But every day they had to complete, it was either every day or every week, there was a certain amount of study hours they had to complete. And there was certain locations where you had like that were acceptable to study. So there was like a little map. It was almost like Google Maps or Apple Maps. And it would like show you where you were, and you could click study in certain buildings because it would know where you were. So that's, my one.
So there you go. It goes beyond recruitment week. Yeah. It's following you throughout your experience.
I don't know how many of the sororities and fraternities use stuff like that, but I do know in like my one experience of seeing it.
Yeah. I was trying to like investigate this app before we recorded, and I was just like, this does a lot of stuff on here. So I don't know which campuses, if the U does utilize it, but it does show when you're registering online at the U, they have that campus director. And when you click on privacy policies, it does bring up Technify. So they are linked at some point if they're using them in the process. It streamlines everything, but it's crazy what they're collecting for it.
I guess if we've learned anything that's streamlined, it doesn't mean it doesn't come with a price, you know?
Yeah. And it sounds like it is a free app for the kids the students to download, but it's the school that takes on purchasing that product for them so that it's not passed on to the students.
Let's take a brief break for this message from our sponsor. The global average cost of a data breach is nearly $4.5 million, but that's viewing it from a liability perspective. Today, privacy is a value proposition for software providers. When you develop a reputation for protecting customers' personal information, you don't just acquire new customers, you make them loyal. And Pseudo Platform is the world's premier cloud platform for providing developers with a menu of enterprise-ready SDKs and APIs that make integrating privacy solutions into your software so easy. Built for developers by developers, from identity wallets and password managers to virtual cards and secure encrypted communications, Pseudo Platform has you covered. Go to market quickly with a privacy platform that is scalable, flexible, and secure. To learn more, visit pseudoplatform.com. That's pseudoplatform.com.
So we have a lot of great blog articles around, you know, when school is about to start, around educators and using it as students. So I'm going to go through one that's sort of like a top 9 ways that you can use MyPseudo as a college student. So the first one is socializing. So keeping up with new and old friends and family with messaging, calling, video, group chat, and all that stuff. Another one is apartment hunting and roommate hunting. You might not want to give every person who applies to your room to let add to your personal phone and email. So same goes for your landlord who lives maybe out of state. Use a separate pseudo for those, you know, short-lived or impersonal contacts until you're ready to share more personal information. The other one we've touched on, but it also applies to college students, is dating. We know that dating isn't all heart emojis and chocolates. There are real risks along with the rewards. So personal safety is one of those risks, whether you meet on a dating app or in person. Maintaining a separate dating pseudo and giving out the pseudo number instead of your own is a sensible privacy and personal safety strategy that puts you in control until you feel ready to share more. And the other one I've just mentioned is campus activities. You can keep track of all your co-curriculars like tutoring, book clubs, sorority or fraternity, charity work. We talked about the MUS club. You can keep it all in one dedicated pseudo and or sign. You know, I talked about recruitment software. If it's asking for your email or phone number, you can use that. Research and coursework. Search privately and securely using your designated pseudo private browser because you should get to decide how much or how little privacy invasive tracking to let into your life. and buying textbooks and supplies. Shopping is one of the most popular uses of MySudo. You could use a shopping pseudo to privately and securely create online and store accounts, get coupons, offers and rewards, research products, and even check out and pay. Another one is study groups. You just mentioned that one. Keep your contacts organized and separate from your personal information. Only share private details when you're ready. Number 8 is communicating with faculty. Keep your comms with your teacher organized and separate so you always know who's calling or who you're texting for that deadline extension. And that could also be if there's any software that maybe the teachers are using. And the last one is for commuting. If you're a commuter student, you might want to organize all the details of your ride to and from campus, bus, train pass, car registration, car parking permits and gas, etc. Do you have any that you would add to the list or where you were like, God, I wish I would have had a pseudo to use
yeah,
that?
Yeah, definitely. I think I have two. So the first one, after you just talked about communicating with faculty, I have a quick story. So there was one assignment. It was for a personal selling class and we had to film an elevator pitch. I at the time I was working retail, long night. I was in management, you know, taking care of the store. I had to close the store. I come back. And the assignment was due at like 10 p.m. And I got home at like nine. And I was like, I'm not doing this. It wasn't that many points, you know. I'm sure we've all been through that.
Pros and cons.
I get a text message from the professor at like 9:15. Hey Connor, I saw that this wasn't turned in. I'll extend it to midnight.
Oh shoot.
And I'm terrified. My personal phone number.
He's making you a deal.
Yeah.
So he just accessed your number from like campus directory. So, interesting.
So yeah, that's why when you said that, I was like, yeah, I wish I had a tool like this to put in, you know, the university personal information on myself because that you never think you're going to get a personal text message from your professor. And I mean, since then, I've had other professors that I've texted personally, but I reached out to them through their personal number on, you know, Canvas, because they said if it's like, oh, if it's an emergency, just text me, you know. And there's been certain things.
And Canvas, again, is what?
It's like where all your assignments are, where
it's
you
like
talk
the student directory almost. It's where all your classes are, all the class information. It's like there's no more like handing teachers things. You turn it in online. Oh, I gotcha. You know?
But that's not the same system as what you use to register for classes.
No, it's different. So there's two of those. So the Canvas is mainly for like your schooling, your grades. And then they call it, I don't know. I think it might be an acronym. I just call it CIS.Utah.
Oh, yep. Yeah. It's like ringing bells for me. Like, yep. Oh, campus information system.
Yep. Thank you.
There you go.
Yeah. So, and that's what you use to access, you know, transcripts, access your registration, access your schedule, access the entire schedule for registration, you know.
That's crazy that professors are so accessible. Cause I know when I was just like one of, 50 kids in a class and they were like, unless you have something to say after class, don't talk to me. Yeah. Just turn your stuff in.
So that was the first story about how my professor texted me personally. I ended up turning in the assignment. I got scared into it. I said, all right, I'll do the elevator.
I mean, it's very nice of him, but you're like, how did you get my number?
I know. And after like a long day of work too, you know, I was in bed. I was ready to go to sleep and I got a text. So that was one of them where I wish I would have had the ability, because I know with MySudo, under the subscription, you're allowed a phone number. So, you know, a way for them to, it would have been in my app. It would have felt a lot nicer. You
know? A little separate.
Yeah. And then the second thing is, and this is probably a very, very modern thing for schooling. I don't imagine you went through anything like this, Sarah. But, and it could be also mainly business school thing, but we had to sign up for simulations or textbooks. And a lot of times I would use my personal email because the U-mail they give you, it's long to type out. I could never remember the whole thing.
It's like you and then 8 numbers. Yeah, you're like, I'm never going to remember
this.
It's
your student ID and then it's like at umail.utah.edu or something. But so I always just use my personal email because I check it often. So if anything came through. But now after the classes are over, I'm getting, you know, all this school spam. I was interested in the UI UX program at the University of Utah, signed up for that on my personal email. And then a week later I was getting ads or like newsletters about different UI UX programs, not even the University of Utah's.
Oh, but see, I was like, that tells you it's being like yeah. sent out.
I was like, how did my email end up in this pool? So in that regard, I think MySudo would have been great for me personally. I could think of countless other uses going through college. So I do recommend college students at the very least download the app. You know, I'm not saying I know that college students aren't made of money, but even, you know, the base subscription is $1 a month and just having that ability to have a different email where you can kind of organize it and not have your personal information tracked.
Yeah. It's not like you need to create 9 pseudo profiles. You can just have your college one and then you're just sort of separating yourself.
Yeah.
Or if you're on the free version and you get your buddies to sign up, then you can, you're
communicating for free.
Exactly.
Through the handles.
Exactly. So there's so many uses for it. It's something that I wish I had knowledge about. I do think this is something either students should know about or like the university needs to either provide like MySudo for students or something like it.
Maybe
like,
you need to be up there that first week of school when they're all up there with the activity tables.
We should set up a table.
Yeah.
It's like orientation university. Week.
No, definitely. I think it would help a lot, you know.
I think orientation week would be helpful because you've got probably a lot of parents attending with their kids and they're like, oh.
Yeah, especially the ones from out of state who are like leaving their kid there already worried enough.
How about football home games?
Oh, yeah.
Tailgating with MySudo. You charged something when I was in grad school at the University of Illinois. It was kind of a weird one. I took this class. I didn't like the professor. I forget what it was. It was like digital media, something of that nature. And after the class was over, like it was done, that semester was done, he sent me a Facebook friend request. I'm not really active on Facebook anyway.
You left an impression. He wanted to be your friend.
Yeah, he really did. It was, I guess.
That's extra.
And so I declined it. And then 2 weeks later, he sent it again.
It is such a different day and age. Like I know I see even high schoolers in junior high where they're connecting with their teachers on social media. And to me, it's just so weird. Like teachers were just, you saw them at school. And as soon as that bell rang, they didn't exist, you know? And if you saw them outside, you were like, oh my gosh, that's so weird. That's Mrs. Jones, you know, you're like, yeah, don't see them. And now everything is so personal and they're friends with everyone. And I think it's muddying the lines for a lot of problems and stuff like that. But it's crazy to me that students and teachers are just so freely connecting now.
Well, I noticed in grad school, it's different. Like in grad school, you're like buddies with the professors.
Right, because
like
you're there.
You go eat hamburgers together. Yep. It's
a different focus.
Very different, yeah.
Yeah, it's a different focus
very
for sure.
Different. But there does feel to be that, it's like the disintegration of that wall.
Right.
Right, the separation's not as strong as it used to be, so.
Yep.
Well, cool. Well, unless you got anything else, Connor, I think we're going to wrap it up.
Download MySudo.
It's crazy to hear what college has been like the last few, even the last, like I could say 10 years since I was there, but the last few years have just changed the game for how kids are going to school now. It's crazy. You've got to stay on top of it.
Yeah. And there's even some people too, I mean, to really get out there questioning how much longer the higher education model will last just because it's become so expensive.
So expensive. Sure. And there's so many classes that I'm like, God, I think I took bowling like 3 times and, you know, just to be like, gol, I just need 5 credits to graduate. And you're just like taking pointless classes. Even some of the generals, you're like, I don't need to take astronomy class. You know, I think trades will become so big. If you know what you want to do, just go in and focus on it. I think it is. It's going to be interesting to see how that shifts. Even by the time my kids are in it, I'm like, I don't even know what to prepare for because it could be different in another 10 years.
Yeah. Learn how to work on a Tesla. And without getting electrocuted. Well, Connor, I appreciate you coming in and talking to us. This has been awesome.
Yeah. Thank you both so much for the opportunity. It was great.
It was fun.
Yeah. Good, fresh perspective. And, you know, maybe we'll get you in again, talk about something else here down the road.
Hopefully. I'm always willing.
Thanks again, Connor.
Yep.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode. In our next episode, Mr. Metaverse is returning as the two of us will be continuing our previous discussion on AI and privacy. Until next time, don't forget, privacy is a human right.